Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Joan Herman. Today I'm speaking with Terry Steenbergen, who has served as executive director for 8 months of The Harbor, a nonprofit Astoria-based organization that provides advocacy, prevention, and support for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. Steenbergen's eclectic background includes developing a pilot women's mentorship program for Portland-based Mercy Corps and heading the humanitarian organization's Central African Republic offices. She also directed a campaign to tax sugar-sweetened beverages in Oregon and has volunteered on a crisis line. Steenbergen earned a bachelor's degree in religious studies from Boston University and a master's in public health from Oregon State University with an emphasis on gender-based violence. This program was pre-recorded. Welcome to the studio, Terry.
Thanks, John. I'm really happy to be here.
You've been here about 8 months now. How is your work going?
It's going really well. We're really busy all the time, but the organization's really great, and we have a great staff, so things are good.
And for people who may not know what The Harbor is, why don't you explain what the organization does?
Okay. As you mentioned, we provide advocacy and resources for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking throughout Clatsop County. Our mission is actually to provide advocacy, prevention, and support to promote self-determination and hope for all survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. And that includes survivors regardless of race, religion, gender, identity, sexual orientation, ability, national origin, immigration status, physical or mental abilities, marital or veteran status.
So you mentioned you work with all genders, so not just women.
Yeah, I know we were called the Women's Resource Center in the past, and the reason that we changed the name to The Harbor is that we do actually serve all genders.
And talk about some of the services that you provide specifically.
Okay. Well, there's quite a few, actually. So we have, first of all, a 24-hour crisis line. So we are available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
And what is that number?
It's 503-325-5735. And anybody can call that at any time during the day to reach an advocate. So we do have advocates on call.
And are those local advocates staffing it?
They are, yes. So they're based here in Astoria. And even if somebody isn't in immediate crisis, they're welcome to call the line as well if somebody just needs to talk or has something going
on. Great.
And then, and I think people know we have a confidential shelter that we reopened this year, and that is for survivors of domestic violence who need a confidential emergency shelter. So folks who are fleeing a particularly dangerous situation and might be, just might need a confidential location.
And is that just for women and children?
The shelter serves also anybody, regardless of gender or any of the other things. So,
sure. Yeah. And how many people do you have room for?
We have space for 4 families or 12 individuals, but we say 4 families because we'll never house people in the same room if they're not in the same family.
Okay.
So we like to think of it more as a home rather than what people normally think of as a shelter.
And has that kept full since it was reopened?
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, that's quite a service.
There's a great need for it, unfortunately.
Yes. And yeah, what about some other services?
We provide individual case management. Our office is open Monday through Friday from 9 to 4 p.m., except on Wednesdays where we're only open until noon. And that is for drop-in services, so people can come down to the office at any time and speak to an advocate. We provide legal referrals and protective orders. So we are right across the street from the courthouse. So we get a lot of folks coming in who need help with restraining orders or other types of protective orders. And we will often accompany some survivors to the courthouse as well. We do safety planning. I think that's a big part of what we do. And safety planning means that, you know, whatever situation that somebody is in, we help them figure out sort of the best possible way to stay safe. So even if that means a survivor is not ready to leave the abusive situation, we'll figure out how they can stay the safest possible way in the home, or what to do if they decide they do need to leave. And then we have a working partnership with other organizations around Clatsop County. So we work very closely with Clatsop Community Action, DHS, the hospitals, law enforcement, so that we can refer people to any of the other resources that are available throughout the county. And then speaking of the hospitals and law enforcement, we are also part of a domestic and sexual assault response team. And so that means that if law enforcement or the hospitals are working with a survivor at any time during the day and need an advocate to respond, we will actually go out there. So if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and we need to head out and support a survivor at the hospital, we'll do that.
Wow. That's a lot on your plate.
Yes, it is.
And you have a relatively new office space. Would you tell people where that is?
Yes, we're at 801 Commercial Avenue. So like I said, across from the courthouse and also catty corner from the post office.
And you're on the ground floor.
Yes.
So somebody who is in a wheelchair could access the offices from behind
yes.
the building, the parking lot.
Our parking lot is behind the office, so I guess
it is accessible.
Dwayne, and it is accessible, yeah.
Okay. And how many staff members do you have?
We currently have 11 staff.
Wow. And how is the organization funded?
We get a lot of our funding, about 60, 65% of our funding comes from government sources, from federal and state funding. And then we do, after that, we have a pretty substantial foundation funding source. There's also we get some of our funding from the municipal governments also, so the cities provide funding, and then a small portion from individual donors.
Okay. That's impressive that in this small community we can have an organization that has 11 staff members reaching out in this way.
Mm-hmm.
So I know this is an obvious question, but how big is the problem of domestic violence?
I'd say it is rather large, unfortunately. This is a good opportunity for me to throw some statistics at you.
Yeah, please.
We know that actually 1 in 4 women and 1 in 5 teen girls in the United States have experienced physical or sexual violence from an intimate partner. So that's, 20 to 25% of women and girls in the country. And 1 in 7 men over the age of 18 have actually also been victims of intimate partner violence in the U.S. So it's a pretty significant proportion of the community. Just in 2016, the Columbia Memorial in Providence actually did a community health needs assessment and found that over 66% of Clatsop County residents had experienced some sort of adverse life event that resulted in trauma, and that includes physical and sexual violence. So it is of epidemic proportions, I'd say.
Is it as bad as it's ever been or worse?
I think it's probably as bad as it's ever been. It's hard. Domestic and sexual violence, I think, are hard. They're hard to track because if you're doing your job well, the numbers will actually increase because people will then be more likely to report. So unlike in other places where you might think that the numbers would go down, we actually get excited when more people come in.
Okay.
Because that means more people are accessing services. We do know that, when we say something like 1 in 4 women, that doesn't mean all of those people are reporting. There are a chunk that are, and then there's a lot of people that aren't.
Yes. Is our rural area, do we have any unique problems around domestic and sexual violence, or do we pretty much fall in line statistics-wise with the rest of the state?
I'd say we fall pretty much in line statistics-wise with the rest of the state in the matter of the numbers-wise. So one thing I also wanted to mention is that an estimated 1 million Oregon women and girls, which is over half of the population, the female population of Oregon, has experience some form of sexual or domestic violence, and we definitely fall sort of in that in that realm. I think the thing that makes it a little harder living in a rural county like Clatsop County is that just the access to resources is a little trickier than it would be in a place like Multnomah County.
Well, how do you reach out to survivors who are in a rural area, which makes it more complicated and difficult to get out of an abusive situation?
So we will actually meet survivors where they're at, both, I mean, I guess that's both physically, emotionally, and psychologically, if you will. But in a physical sense, because of transportation and lack of access to transportation, and because often survivors are isolated by their abusers, it is hard for survivors to get to us. So we will actually go and meet them, preferably in public locations that we decide are safe. But mm-hmm. if you know we need to go to Cannon Beach or we need to go to Jewel, we'll drive out there and meet with survivors there. And also, there are some time constraints. You know, people work from 9 to 5 and so maybe can't come to the office in that period of time. And so we will actually set up appointments after hours to meet with folks if that's what they need also. So we're pretty available to go anywhere at any time, just knowing that the you know resources aren't necessarily there for people to always get to where we are.
What would you say are the main causes of domestic and sexual violence?
I mean, domestic violence and sexual violence are all about power and control. And so it is one person exerting power over another person and trying to control that person's life. And so that's, I think, another good thing to remember is that doesn't necessarily always mean physical violence. Before there is any physical violence, we'll often see other forms of power and control. So isolation of survivors, both physically and socially. So other forms of violence that are not just physical are, like I just said, isolation, both physically and socially. We have just coercion and threats, which is sometimes, you know, it can be, I'll hurt you if you do this, or I'll hurt myself if you leave me. So somebody saying that they'll commit suicide if you leave them, that is a form of abuse, which I think a lot of people don't realize. There's abusers will use children against survivors. So, you know, if you leave me, I'll take away the kids, you'll never see them again. And that's obviously a really powerful way to, you know, keep somebody somewhere. We see a lot, we do work with undocumented immigrants, and that is definitely a form of abuse, is that abusers will use immigration status against somebody, like, well, you know, I'll report you to ICE, I'll get you sent back to where you came from, because in those situations, abusers are actually citizens or documented in some way. And there's emotional abuse, intimidation. So we'll see a lot of that even before any type of physical abuse will even happen. So I think it's really important if people just feel they feel like something's going on, they're not quite sure if they even need our resources or need to talk to somebody, that people reach out, because those signs, if those signs are there, it is possible that they can escalate at some point and put people in real danger. And the thing that we also know is that it is at that time when somebody decides to leave where the violence actually escalates the most. That is the most dangerous time in the relationship.
And I can't remember the number, but I read it takes quite a number of attempts to leave an abusive relationship before a survivor is actually successful.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that statistic?
Yes. So nationally, the statistic is up to 7 times, but we find in rural locations that it can be up to about 15, and that's mostly because of a lack of resources and understanding around the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, I think it's a, like I said, there's all of these reasons, especially using children, et cetera, but then there's also just, and I think a lot of us are painfully aware that the housing situation has gotten so hard in Clatsop County and other places in Oregon, that if you don't have anywhere to go, leaving just is not an option.
Oh, that wouldn't even occur to me, but of course, that would be the case.
Yep.
If you're just joining me, you're listening to a pre-recorded interview with Terry Steenbergen, who is speaking about her first 8 months serving as the executive director of the Astoria-based nonprofit, The Harbor, which provides services to support survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. I'm Joan Herman on Perspectives on Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria, 91.9 FM, and KTCB Tillamook, 89.5 FM. Before we started the show, you mentioned that you have a training for volunteers coming up.
Yes, we do. We have a training for volunteers coming up, and it is also actually open to the general public. So even if you're not sure you want to volunteer or don't want to volunteer, but want to find out more about the harbor and some of the work that we do, our volunteer training starts tonight in Clatsop Community College, Towler Hall, room 208 from 6 to 8 p.m. And that's a 6-week series that we're running for, again, volunteers and anybody in the community who's interested in finding out more about what we're doing. And some of the topics will include, so on that first day, just an overview of the harbor and also overview of domestic violence and sexual assault, which I think is a particularly interesting day, too, because we will do a sort of what it's like to be a survivor experience at that training. And then other topics include anti-oppression, trauma, getting into a little bit about those that abuse and power and control, some of the legal stuff, and then what the roles and responsibilities of being an advocate are.
Is there any charge for the training?
That training is free, so all are welcome.
Boy, that's a great opportunity. You mentioned before the break that one way that abusers can manipulate someone is if they're undocumented, and the abuser can threaten to inform ICE about their status. How do you reach out to the undocumented population that lives in our area?
We're working on improving that. We do have a good relationship with the Lower Columbia Hispanic Council, and we have on staff, we actually do have a bilingual advocate who is able to work with our Spanish-speaking survivors, because I know that having that language barrier is huge sometimes for folks. But again, we're actually working to improve our services in that for undocumented immigrants, and just which mostly is just reaching out and letting them know that we're there and that it's okay to come to us, and that, you know, we won't tell anybody.
Are they hesitant to come just because you are an organization? Do they worry that they might be reported?
I would say probably. I know that among the undocumented population, it is really hard to reach out to law enforcement. And since we do work with law enforcement or just even to access resources, because it's unclear, you know, what resources are going to do or how people will respond. Mm-hmm. But this is actually probably a good time for me to also mention, which I keep forgetting, is that we are completely confidential. So any survivor, undocumented or not, who comes and uses our services, we are actually required by law to stay completely confidential, so we won't share anything that anybody tells us, actually about anything with anybody, unless specifically asked by the survivor in writing. So I think that's also important to know, is that if you feel uncomfortable talking about whatever is going on, you know, nobody will hear about it except for us.
I mentioned in the introduction that you have a master's in public health with a focus on gender-based violence. What led you to study that specifically?
That's a great question. In my work in politics, I actually have always wanted to work on issues that affect women mostly. And I think gender-based violence is sort of physical representation of a lot of the oppression that women feel, and now and that we know actually people of all genders and orientations actually do feel, and so that I don't know, that's sort of the the reason behind that. And since then, I mean, I think that the work is so important, and you know, we could always have more people sort of in the field, and that was sort of my drive to get in.
That's great. And I also mentioned that you've worked in Africa for several years, it sounds like.
It was a year and a half.
What was that like?
It was amazing and scary and intense and all kinds of other things all at the same time. I was working in a conflict zone, and the work that I was doing in Central Africa was with survivors of gender-based violence and also families who were displaced by conflict.
Wow.
So that was it was an amazing experience. And one of the things that happens in conflict areas all over the world, not just in Africa, is there is actually a rise in gender-based violence in conflict zones, because it is used again for power and control over the oppressed populations, or mm-hmm. or just the enemy, if you will.
Has the Me Too movement had an effect encouraging survivors of violence to come forward?
I think so. I think it's hard to say, really. I know we hear about it more on the news, and I think it's become more prevalent. And I have friends who have admitted that they had no idea like how bad of a problem it really was. And I think that has, I think that's common. I think we hear that more and more. I don't know if, it's not really clear to me if survivors themselves, though, come out more specifically. I think it has definitely raised awareness around the issue, and I think people recognize that. I think people recognize more that we all know a survivor, even if we aren't one ourselves. We definitely know somebody mm-hmm. who has been through some traumatic experience, whether that's domestic violence or sexual assault, stalking, all yes. of them. And I think it's important that's happened, you know.
And do you think that having a president who was recorded joking about grabbing a woman's genitals because he could has affected or made it more, quote unquote, acceptable for harassment against women primarily?
I do. Yes, I do think so. I think, and it's tied to that. I mean, it's tied to that concept of power and control, and it makes it seem okay that it's okay to touch people that haven't invited you to touch them, or even just bully somebody. I think we all know that bullying is a big problem in schools, and now we know the president of the United States is a bully. I don't think anybody can argue with that, and so it does make it seem like that's acceptable, and mm-hmm. that's a problem.
Do you reach out to teens a lot in the schools? Are you able to go into the schools and speak about the work that you do?
We do have a teen outreach program that we're actually trying to bulk up a bit. So we have been in the schools. We have done presentations in the high schools are working with the different principals to figure out how we can be more accessible in the schools, because I think there is... there's prevention that we can do with young people, just in talking about those dynamics of power and control. But I think there's a lot of kids in schools, too, that have definitely had some sort of experience that they don't feel comfortable sharing with somebody. So we would like to also just be there to let them know that we're there to listen to them as well.
Do you ever see a time when there is no domestic violence?
I don't. I mean, definitely not in my lifetime. I think more awareness and more education, especially around the dynamics of power and control, and will decrease it. But I think, given where we are now, and it'll be a long time before that happens.
Do you have any other programs that you would really like to focus on, perhaps either beefing them up or adding to the harbor services?
Well, definitely our outreach to the younger population, to teens. We also are doing some work in diversity, equity, and inclusion at the Harbor. So we've just started an assessment about how we're doing to actually be inclusive, specifically with the LGBTQI+ population, as well as the Latinx, Hispanic populations. And I think that work is extremely important, just generally speaking, to make us more inclusive to the community as a whole. I think we can all, we can all be more inclusive, and we can all recognize that it's important to focus on diversity and equity. We're starting now with an assessment of how we're doing, and then hopefully in the next year we'll be able to do a lot more work on making sure that we become more inclusive.
And you mentioned before the show that you just had a summit on diversity and equity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you're going to have another one.
Yeah. So last night we did actually hold a community forum to start the conversation about how we can be more inclusive, and it was really great. And I would just thank the people who showed up right now. But we will have another one in December and are hoping to continue the work over the next 6 months to get more community feedback, because I can guess of all the reasons that we need to improve, but it's a lot more helpful if the community is actually sharing that with
us. Of course. Yeah, forum was the word I was looking for, not summit. As I'm sure you're aware, you are one of several directors in the last several years. Did that make you a little bit worried before you took the job?
Actually, no. I think because of my work in politics, I'm very used to sort of coming in and to places where either people were working short term or, just there's been some transition. And that was the case when I also went to Africa. So I'm unfazed by it. And it's also
you're used
good,
to it.
It's a good challenge, you know. I appreciate a challenge. And I think it is the nature of this job, unfortunately, that, because we're always working with folks who are in trauma, and I don't work directly with survivors that much. I do a little bit, but it's hard work. And so it's not surprising that there is so much turnover among staff.
I would think avoiding that despair from seeing abuse over and over would be a huge challenge.
Yep. And when you think about the lack of resources and sometimes the systems don't seem to be working with us, they seem to be working against us. So there's a whole lot of things that can make it hard. But I think,
Well, we have just about a minute left. Why don't you push the volunteer training again?
Okay. So our volunteer training / community education series starts tonight at 6:00 in Towler Hall, room 208. And again, tonight's training will be about the harbor and the overview of domestic violence. And then we'll have over the next 6 weeks a good series of other issues that we'll bring up. And I'd also like to say again that if you do want to talk to somebody or do need the harbor, you should call our crisis line at 503-325-5735. And even if you're not in crisis, we're more than happy to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
I want to thank my guest, Terry Steenbergen, who has been speaking about her first 8 months serving as the executive director of The Harbor, the Astoria-based nonprofit provides services supporting survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. This is Perspectives, and I'm your host, Joan Herman. The show is brought to you in part by a grant from the Clatsop County Cultural Coalition. Perspectives was engineered today by Dylan Hauser-Schulk. The show can be heard generally on the first and third Tuesdays of the month on the stations of Coast Community Radio. You also can find show podcasts on the station's website. If you would like to contact me, send me an email to perspectives@coastradio.org. Thanks for listening.